Welcome to Radio Oldies, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and it's a delight for me to be talking to a very old friend today, the author Nicholas Shakespeare, described by the Wall Street Journal as one of the best English novelists of our time. Nicholas sought prominence in 1989 with his first novel, The Vision of Elena Silvers, which won the Somerset Maugham Award and the Betty Trask Award. He went on to win the American Library Association Award for the best novel of the year with The Dancer Upstairs, which was made into a feature film by John Malkovich in 2002. As well as his novels, his non-fiction includes his highly acclaimed biographies of Bruce Chatwin and Ian Fleming, 6 Minutes in May about Winston Churchill, a book he wrote in 2016 as a visiting fellow to All Souls and which was named as Book of the Year by several publications, and a very popular account of his Aunt Priscilla, the hidden life of an English woman in wartime France. The son of a diplomat, Nicholas has had a fascinating life living all over the world, and his new thriller, Frame 37, has just been published. So we have a lot to talk about. Nick, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get on to Frame 37 or any of your books, what few of our listeners will know is that you've had a house in Tasmania for many years and it burnt down in last year's wildfires. Now, I know you've just made a recent trip there to see the damage. Can you tell us what you found?
Crikey. Well, I was about to go out to Tasmania where I spent 2 or 3 months a year writing, and it's been my equivalent of Ian Fleming's Golden Eye, if you like, only it's much nicer. So it's on a beach at the end of the world. The next nearest landmass is the South Pole. And it's an 8-mile beach. I walk on it and I hardly see anybody. And it's been a kind of sanctuary for the imagination for the last 25 years. And it's where I've raised my 2 sons. It's where I've had great friends and family come to stay. And it's really where I feel most alive. And so there I was, about to set out for another 3 months' sojourn. And I received a telephone call from the person who manages it in our apps to say there's a fire advancing towards your house. I just thought to warn you. So for the next 2 hours, I was kind of praying to the gods. I was looking online, seeing that the wind had slightly changed direction.
Did you see photographs of it?
You could see photographs already now with modern technology. You can see the fire. And it was 100-mile-an-hour winds, and it was a 32-degree day. So it was a kind of perfect storm. And then 2 hours later, we receive a telephone call, and I'm on the phone with my youngest son, who was born in Tasmania, and suddenly I hear a scream in the next room, and Gillian, my wife, has been telephoned from the manager to say the simple words, "It's gone." And so 25 years up in flame, and there's nothing left. I mean, it incinerated every single object we had, all my books, my archives, my paintings, our furniture, our bed made out of hewn pine. Not a single thing is left except for a spare set of keys to doors that no longer exist, and a cream jug, which I can show you, and 4 silver knives inscribed with the initials of a distant relative who was Tasmanian. So that's all that's left of 25 years of experience. And I've been trying to kind of battle with what we do. I gathered the family and we went back last month. And to see what we decide to do, whether we turn a page on Tasmania and say that that was a wonderful chapter in our lives, or do we rebuild, or do we hire a Winnebago and plant it there, or do we convert a container? In the end, we've decided to rebuild a small modular house, simpler and more Buddhist-like, so that we can retain a continuation with a place that I love probably more than anywhere else in the world. It really is now just a flattened dune, a midden of kind of oyster shells and sand. So it was really waiting to go up. And I think with climate change and the raising of the sea levels, which I watch every year, because I'm kind of at the coal face of climate change there, you're seeing what's happening with the ocean rises and with temperature change. So that is another kind of alert call to what's happening in the world. I mean, I rather wished I hadn't been the guinea pig for it. We were staying with John le Carré in Cornwall shortly before going out there, And I always loved Le Carré's house in Cornwall. He for many years, he let me a cottage there to write in. For about 35 years, I was on Le Carré's clifftop. And I always fantasized of, God, how could one ever have a place like this? And then we went off to Tasmania, which was as far away from England as I could get at that time, from Bruce Chapman, who I'd been writing a biography of, and the one place he'd never been to was Tasmania. So I wanted to go to a kind of Chapman-free zone. We went off to Tasmania, and this is before I got married, and we found this place on a beach, which was even lovelier than Le Carré's house, and much lovelier than Ian Fleming's house that I subsequently visited.
In Jamaica.
In Jamaica. Yeah. But it was where I could read. I mean, I read all of the books that I should have read, like you at Cambridge when we read English. I mean, I should have read Proust and all these other writers. And there in Tasmania, I was not able to write, but I was able to read. So it's a very special place in my heart.
So let's talk about your writing now. So now, Frame 37 has just come out. And for those of you who haven't read it yet, I suggest you quickly do. It's a book that creeps up on you. So it starts quite gently with a group of university friends, but following a horrific rape which they witness, it quickly moves into the most terrifying book, set against a big background of looking for the American presidential candidate. What inspired this book?
Well, my memory is kind of so shot to pieces, given the last 5 years, because what happened was I'd begun writing it in 2019 in Tasmania, and suddenly I get a call from my agent in London, Claire Alexander, who says, we've got a really interesting approach from the Fleming estate. They would like you to do a new biography of Ian Fleming, an authorised new biography. Would you be interested? And I kind of hummed and hawed. I wasn't that interested in Ian Fleming at the time. I was much more interested in his brother, Peter.
Gosh, and now you're the great global expert on Ian Fleming.
The point is, I thought, this might get my sons through university, and I'll probably get a publisher for it. So I, in the end, I kind of put my novel on hold. And so I'd written a couple of chapters and mapped it out a bit. But what's extraordinary is when I came back to it after finishing the Fleming, was to see how the plot had, in a sense, been mimicked by what was then going on in the world. With this novel, Frame 37, it's probably the only novel I've written that actually could have a sense that it's kind of echoing what's going on in the world as we experience it. And it's about a kind of corrupt political system in America that appoints at short notice a replacement for a Trump-like figure who resigns for no reason. And then it was about a rape case, a historical rape case. And I think you have just reminded me that it was probably in the water at the time was that incredible episode of Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the chairman of the International Monetary Fund, who was a shoo-in for the president of France until he rapes a woman, a cleaner, in a hotel in New York. And I hadn't thought of it until you reminded me. And I think that must have been one of the things circulating in my head when I conceived of this plot, to have a kind of person 40 years on, a crime they committed 40 years ago, suddenly being the possible reason why, to prevent them from taking over the presidency. And another kind of possible grain of inspiration was to discover the rather astonishing news that Laura Bush, who was the future wife of George Bush Sr., when she was an undergraduate, age 17 or 18, she had killed a fellow student in a car accident. And this had been kept really under wraps for all through his presidency, and no one knew much about it, and it came out kind of after his presidency, and I thought that was absolutely gripping, that you could use the state to somehow suppress something of that magnitude. I mean, she wasn't accused of murder or anything, it was manslaughter, but it still was a pretty dramatic incident to keep quiet about. So I think that those two, I must have elided the Strauss-Kahn and the Laura Bush into some idea that you could have a really disgusting incident took place years ago that was witnessed by three or four people and recorded on camera. And so, which is what takes place in the novel. It's recorded on a Leica, which with analog film. So the title, Frame 37, is about the 37th frame on a roll of 36 films. And apparently, if you're careful with rolling the films on, you can squeeze an extra shot or two shots out of a 36-frame film. And I thought this was really exciting that you could tease the reader by did he or did he not capture the rape on the film. And he doesn't know if he's caught it because the camera goes missing for 40 years. And so I got really interested in, all during this period, it's taken about 5 years to write, all during this period you had under threat also local journalism, and you had all the kind of former tools that we use, you and I used as journalists, of research, proper kind of going into the background, finding evidence, all was under threat from Trump and the and elsewhere, and especially photography, so that now anybody could say, oh, that film, it's fake news, that photograph is drummed up by AI. Well, you can't do that with old-fashioned film.
Can I talk to you about the cover of your book for a minute? Because it made me very cross. Because you are a really brilliant, you know, to me, that you are a very serious literary novelist. And this cover is, I don't know if that's going to be the final cover, because I've read the proof copy, but it's a bit of a airport thriller cliche cover. And what do you feel about it, I wonder?
Well, I think writers at the moment just feel relieved they're going to be published. So that, and what I feel is that I have no longer any say over how it is bracketed. So I imagine they think they're going to make more sales by marking it as a thriller and putting that on the cover. So I have, I mean, it seems...
Just describe the cover for our readers.
The cover is of a man, listeners, slightly plumper than I imagined my hero to be, running away through some trees.
In a raincoat,
which, again, I wasn't thinking of him in a raincoat. But it's, I quite like it in terms of, it's quite arresting as a cover. I mean, I've had some really bad covers in the past. As a thriller cover, I think it's quite good, but I don't think my novel's a thriller. And I think people who are in the genre of who are expert thriller readers will be disappointed, possibly, by the fact that it doesn't abide by traditional thriller rules, which I'm not sure I know anyway.
If small ship cruising around Scotland appeals, or you've been curious since hearing about Hebridean Island cruises on Radio Aldi, this might be the moment to take a look. Hebridean Princess explores the Western Islands and coastline, and Lord of the Highlands winds through the Highlands and Caledonian Canal, both in genuine all-inclusive luxury for fewer than 50 guests. Cabins are still available on selected sailings this summer and autumn, with up to 20% off, plus standard UK rail or air travel to the ship included. Visit hebridean.co.uk or call the team on 01756 704 704.
So tell us about your hero, John Dyer, because it's his third outing, isn't it?
So he, I like you, I read English at Cambridge, and possibly like you, I came under the influence of people like Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh, but also Conrad, who I now really like, much more than I liked him when I was younger. I mean, I feel that there should be a sell-by date or read-by date on certain novelists, because I think too many people read Conrad too early.
Yeah, I quite agree.
And it's like a malt whiskey. You need to be a bit older before you really savour the taste of it. Anyway, Conrad, I've come back to, because I grew up in Cambodia, which was the setting for Lord Jim. And I remember Peter O'Toole coming through our house in Phnom Penh in 63 or 64 with the film crew to film it with David Lean. So that must have stuck in my head. And I was rereading Conrad. And I love the idea in Conrad. He has always this narrator called Marlowe,
yes,
who is the kind of waiter for the story. And what happened, it's a wonderful device. And I liked the idea of an intermediary between you and reality, because it makes the reality strangely more real by having it at one remove, instead of going straight in, which is... So when Malkovich made a film of The Dancer Upstairs, which is John Dyer's first outing, we remove the character of John Dyer. The camera lens becomes the narrator, and you go straight into the action. You don't need an intermediary. But I think in a novel, you do need the scene set. If you go straight in, it can be slightly in a strange way, it reacts against the reality of the reader's experience.
But he's actually central to the plot in this case. He saves the day.
He saves the day. So, yeah. But how he began was as the waiter to a plot.
Interesting.
And so, well, a bit, when I started to write research the Ian Fleming biography, I suddenly saw that he was having problems with Bond, because when Bond begins in Casino Royale, we don't know too much about him. But every time he writes another Bond book, he has to kind of excavate a bit more biographical detail. And by the end, you know, finally he admits that Bond is Scottish like him and has all the same taste. But I found the same thing when I brought out Dyer for my second novel about him, called The Sandpit, which is set in Oxford, and it's a thriller, which, funny enough, is now being slightly mirrored in reality, but it's all about the Iranians discovering nuclear fission in Oxford. And I kind of had to excavate slightly into myself to bring him a bit more three-dimensional. So John Dyer is essentially a South American foreign correspondent who is made redundant slightly when a telegraph-like newspaper decides that the accountant says, you know, shut down Rio de Janeiro and shut down your offices there. So I grew up my dad was a foreign correspondent at the Times. I grew up with the idea of foreign correspondence as a glamorous job. So in a sense, John Dyer was a kind of Latin American correspondent for many years, a very successful one, covering the continent. And then his newspaper closes him down. So he decides to stay on in South America. And it's then that he still has the training to track down a story and research a story. And he's particularly drawn to stories that can't ever be printed. When I left journalism, journalism was a young person's profession, and so I had a wonderful time in my
20s. Why do you say that?
Because I think you're so innocent in a way of thinking that people are listening to you and you are after the truth and the truth counts. And that's what keeps you going until you realise it's actually all in the proprietor's interest. So I grew up with this slightly naive idea that I'm a truth teller, seeker, and that's why I joined the BBC and everything. And we were still in those days able to operate under those illusions. And when I joined the Telegraph, I felt with Max Hastings, the editor, I was, you know, he was a spirit after my own heart. He'd been the most amazing foreign correspondent in the Falklands, in Vietnam, and he wanted, what we wanted was to the truth of a story. And, you know, bit by bit, you realise that actually Conrad Black was pulling the strings, and it's what he wanted that counted. And I remember I was using a rather nice young writer called Pierre Hodgson to review for me when I was the literate of the Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph. And I remember the biography of Henry Kissinger came out, and Pierre Hodgson kind of dismissed it in the paperback columns as, you know, he's a war criminal and everything. Well, we did this despite the fact that Kissinger was on the board of Hollinger, which owned the Telegraph. Anyway, I was summoned by Conrad Black. You know, how are you using this man? And I said, well, look, I'm using him. That's what he felt about Kissinger. And to be honest, I lived in Cambodia just before Kissinger completely ruined the country, and I quite agree with him that Kissinger's a war criminal. Anyway, Conrad Black, to his kind of, you know, credit, didn't fire me. And allowed me to go on using Pierre Hodgson. But basically, that's the last kind of period, I suspect, when we had that latitude.
What changed, do you think? What do you see as the moment it really turned and ceased to matter?
I think it's when powers that be, without naming names, perceive newspapers as either reflecting their ability to influence things. Mm. And I think what's happened is that people nakedly see it as a way of putting pressure on, I mean, as you see with Murdoch, in America and in Australia and other names that shan't be mentioned. So I think that's changed totally. And also you don't now trust, people don't read newspapers in the way I do. I always bought a newspaper. I don't read newspapers now.
Where do you get them. Your foreign, you know, given you've lived in so many different places in the world and know them so well, where do you go for trusted information now?
So I'm an old BBC hand. You know, I was there for several years making documentaries, and I still, my grandfather, who was quite a well-known broadcaster in the war for the BBC.
Who's that?
A man called S.P.B. Mace, who kind of became very, very famous. My mother's father was very famous in the war, but he did the kitchen front. He did lots of broadcasts to the troops and He had been a teacher at Sherborne. He'd taught Alec Waugh. He'd bought The Loom of Youth published. And he had taught Antonia Fraser and John Mortimer and people at the Dragon School, who all very much revered his method of teaching. And he was quite a formidable... He'd read 200 or 300 books. I think he must have been bipolar, because he was kind of writing 6 books a year to keep his family alive. And he was quite an influential person in my life, only in as much as I didn't want to become like him, because he ended up totally poor, and his wife, my grandmother, ran off when he was 90, and ran off and married a man who'd first proposed to when she was 17, and he died kind of heartbroken and bankrupt, my grandfather. And I felt, if that's what it is to be a writer, count me out. And only bit by bit did I kind of, you know, creep into the writer's study, and possibly the second writer I knew and was vastly influenced by was Jorge Luis Borges, who I used to see in Argentina where we lived, and I would go to his flat in Maipú and read to him from Kipling and Hamlet, and I hadn't really read him at all, but I then started to read Borges, and I was working in my gap year on an Argentine estancia before I went up to Cambridge, and as a cowhand on horseback. And it was a time of the government was kind of stirring up problems with the Malvinas, the Falklands, to try and distract the population from all the death squads. And it was quite a crime to be young in that period. And I remember, and it was a crime to be English too, so I remember as a cowhand, I would ride my kind of pony rather hopelessly into the local village and tether it up outside the bar. And it was a bit like in Bonanza that I'd watched as a child.
I love Bonanza.
And I was having a steak with an egg on top in the corner one night when a man drunkenly, a kind of gaucho with a knife, comes up and he hears I'm English and threatens me outside for a knife fight. And I kind of quiver, no hablo español, no hablo español, until he's disarmed. But I remember telling Borges this story, and I hadn't read his famous short story, The South, which I think Nick Rogue turns into a film with Mick Jagger. And Borges kind of is gripped by my story, because it's enacting what I later discovered was exactly the narrative of his story. But Borges, subsequently, I got him on a television program later after the Falklands War with Vargas Llosa, the wonderful Peruvian novelist, and Bruce Chatwin. Again, in those periods, no one had ever heard of these people, but it was a wonderful show. And anyway, this Borges was a very big influence on me, I now realise, and as was Graham Greene, who also had written about Argentina during this period when I was, you know, an influenceable adolescent. I think it's Borges and Graham Greene made me decide I could become a writer, whereas my grandfather had been a kind of warning about what happens if you do.
So it's interesting. Can we just go back? Because in 1993, you were photographed by Granta, which they do only every 10 years, as one of the great young novelists. And amongst those novelists were people who really sort of shot up, you know, Kazuo Ishiguro and household namey people. Do you feel you've missed out on that? Because you are so highly acclaimed, but you sort of that level of fame of those other people in that photograph with you haven't necessarily achieved. And is that because you think... Why is that, do you think?
I think I'm the last person who can answer that question, but I don't... I may have been insulated by working for the BBC, where every day I'm meeting somebody famous and having dinner with them and becoming friends with them. So, you know, I became a friend of Germaine Greer, who lent me her house in Italy to write, and I became friends with many of the people I was interviewing. And I think watching...
And you go out, you've had girlfriends who are incredibly famous.
Well, we won't talk about this, but I had girlfriends, but the point is... I think I watched fame, I watched its operation on people, and I could see what was needed, possibly. I've always slightly resisted the opportunity that you could use to make yourself kind of more present in people's minds. I've always felt the work should do it. And I always get irritated by people who are interviewed the whole time for their novelists or who call themselves writers just after having published one novel. I mean, I don't only feel now am I able to call myself a writer or
so
an author. But I don't know what the reason is, but I've always shrunk from this, you know, I don't do interviews, for instance. I mean, in England, I don't do print interviews. I mean, I hope the book is going to prove its way, without my help blathering about it like I'm doing now. I'm only doing this because you're an old friend. No, it would be nice to be better known. It'd be nice to be better read. It'd be nice to be richer. But I feel lucky that I've been able to write the books that I've wanted to write. I can see the danger of too early fame, because you're then, like, I remember staying with Le Carré a lot, and I became very, very close to him, in as much as he would allow people to come close to him. But I remember watching him and talking about the book he wrote called The Naive and Sentimental Lover, which was a disaster as far as he was concerned, because it was panned, because it wasn't a spy novel, and he was so horrified by the reception that he beetled back into the spy novel and never escaped it. And my feeling was how sad, because in a sense, success is, as Graham Greene said, is just failure postponed. And I like to adapt the Graham Greene phrase to that I think failure is just success postponed. And I felt that you should fail, you should be allowed to fail. And when success comes, you should have had all your, you know, your experiments that you wanted to do. And I always felt Le Carré did himself down by not being braver. He could have won the Nobel Prize if he'd been brave enough to have ripped down the fence posts of the genre novel. But he crept back into it. He then wrote probably his best novel, A Perfect Spy. But
I felt, brilliant,
which is brilliant. Yeah. But brilliant, I felt he never gave himself the opportunity, because he wanted success too much. As long as you're doing what you like, that's the greatest success you could have, and it's still being published. I mean, I think I'll be very sad if, you know, my next novel, the publisher turns it down.
Have you had a novel turned down yet?
No, but I haven't written that many. But I mean,
have you written it? It's about eight.
This is my eighth. I had read a collection of short stories, and this is my eighth novel.
But I think it's really interesting what you're saying. So if a newspaper comes along and says, can we do a double-page spread on you?
No, I mean, I don't want to sound pie about this, but I mean, I have done so many interviews like you have, and I know all the tricks of the interviewer. If you don't like somebody, you can really kind of stitch them up, and then it's there forever now. But I do interviews abroad. You know, if I go to India for a literary festival or a...
I'll talk on a stage.
Oh, yeah, I'll talk on a stage, but I mean, I'll do it with local journalists. Yeah. I'll do that. There, but I feel with the English, I'm too wary of it.
And they don't read your books. I remember you being furious.
Oh yes, that's the other thing. I mean, they fit you in between, you know, whatever, and they haven't read your books. And I think the one thing you have to do when you interview an author is to read
do the work.
Books,
yeah. Mm. What next? What are you going to write next?
I'm halfway through a novel, which many of my stories are inspired by a wonderful Australian writer called Murray Bale, who is one of my favourite people on earth. Wonderful writer who's slightly having a bad time at the moment, because he's the character in Helen Garner's much lauded journals as the husband who doesn't treat her as well as she expects to be treated.
Oh dear.
And marvellous writer, marvellous man. He's given me the idea for a novel, so I'm halfway through that.
Where's it set?
It's set in Lule in Portugal. Ooh. And it begins with a man walking down a street, and suddenly a dress comes out of the sky and wraps his face, and he tries to tears it off his face, and he tries to look for where the dress has come from.
What an incredibly intriguing beginning. We can't wait to read that. So I think just to sum up... it's really interesting talking to you, because I think what our listeners...
But you say that to all the girls,
don't you? No, but I think our listeners will glean from this that you are so clearly passionate about what you're doing that really doesn't matter about the fame, does it? I mean, do you feel bitter at all?
What do you want about fame? I mean, I think it's wonderful to be able to be writing books that are then published. Mm. And if they're read by discerning readers like you...
I've read all your books.
No, but I'm really pleased. I mean, Tom Kinnaird, I've just been seeing him in Sydney. I mean, he's just raved about this novel. And that, to me, is, like, unbelievable that he... sees the point of it, and William Boyd sees the point of it, and so when somebody sees the point of it, that to me is success. I mean, what is success otherwise? I mean, what, people have bestsellers? I mean, I've had a bestseller. I mean, I don't know what it is. I just want to write the best I can. And I think it's a privilege. Finally, I have a wonderful editor, Liz Foley at Harvill, and she kind of unscrambled the first draft of this. And the pleasure in getting it right and not rushing it. And so, but I think, you know, watching Ian Fleming, he could have been a much better writer if he'd spent a bit more time on his books. But he only did 2 months a year and did them in 2 months and never kind of polished them or spent more time on them. I don't think he possibly could, because I think he was probably bipolar. But, you know, he always was envious of people like Graham Greene, who took the time it took. And, you know, a novel takes the time it takes. Mm. It's not like an AI thing, which... I mean, I looked at the AI the other day about what I should do next, because AI tells you what a Nicholas Shakespeare novel should now be, and there are four plots it offered me, none of which I was interested in, but I could see how it had got to those plots.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, you're living in a very beautiful place here in Wiltshire, and just end on a lovely note, just tell our listeners about your Russian Avenue, so, which we've just walked down.
Probably long after my books are forgotten, and I'm forgotten, and I haven't achieved the fame you would wish for me. What will be remembered...
No, I'd like to stay exactly as you are, issuing it.
What will be remembered is in 2014, so 12 years ago, I was part of a group of writers who were invited by the Russian Ministry of Art to Russia to visit the dachas of various Russian writers, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Tuchev, and...
Turgenev.
Yeah. And Norman Stone was part of the party, and David Campbell had organised it, the publisher of Everyman, and Charles Cummings and Ben McIntyre. And we had a terrific time. Anyway, David Campbell, whenever we went to one of these dachas, he reminded us that these trees, the oaks and the apple trees and the cherry trees, were planted by the writers themselves. And we happened to be there when the oak from Tolstoy's tree that he had planted was shedding acorns. Ditto with the oak that Chekhov had planted. Ditto with the apple tree and the apples that Turgenev had planted. And so I brought back in my pocket one apple from a Turgenev tree, and I bought about 6 or 7 acorns from the trees of the other writers. I then planted them in pots. I'm not a gardener at all. I planted them in pots in my Oxford patio and went off to Australia. When I came back, they'd all germinated. Anyway, I now have a Russian Avenue in Wiltshire. I won't tell you the location, because I'm terrified people will come and pinch the fruits and the acorns. A Russian Avenue of all acorns and three apple trees from a Turgenev apple. And it's fantastic. And they're flowering. And this year we had more apples from the Turgenev apple tree. And I promise people, if you're a Chekhov fan, I'll give you a Chekhov acorn. If you're a Dostoevsky fan, you can have a Dostoevsky acorn in due course. What would you like? Which one would you like?
I mean, obviously Tolstoy's a giant, but I do love Turgenev.
Okay. You can have a Turgenev apple. And that will make you even sweeter.
What a way to end. Nick Shakespeare, thank you so much for being on Radio Aldi.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with the author Nicholas Shakespeare. If you've enjoyed listening to our conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My thanks again to you, Nick, for a wonderful conversation, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Bailey Gifford, actual investors who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.